While Dr. Magnuson prepares his PowerPoint for you, let me just make a couple of announcements, and so you'll understand a couple of things that we'll be making available to you, and we'll have these forms available to you at the break that we're going to take after Dr. Magnuson. And by the way, at the end, Dr. Kuchera will be able to come back, and we'll have a Q&A time at the final moments. But we are recording today, and we are simply doing it by audio today. And so, but we will have an MP3 audio order form available to you if you want to order an audio version of today, and we'll make that available to you, and there'll be a form for you to fill out. And then the other thing that we're doing, some of you are missing page 2, I think, of Dr. Drake's notes, and she's running copies of those, and we'll have those available for you here in just a little bit, okay? Let me introduce Dr. Ken Magnuson to you. It's in the front.
I did the same thing.
Dr. Ken Magnuson is an associate professor of Christian ethics here at Southern Seminary. If you were to look at the various publications and articles and papers that Dr. Magnuson has presented to the Evangelical Theological Society, for example, and the various publications that he has written on various ethical issues, you would understand why we've invited him here and what a treat it is to have him come and share with you for a few moments. Also, it's just a treat for me because I also get to see Dr. Magnuson in his local church ministry and the way that he teaches and the way that he helps as he serves in our deacon ministry and others at our home church. And so he's not only here as a professor but as a minister, and I know that you'll look forward to hearing from Dr. Ken Magnuson. So I will turn it over to him.
All right. And I'm hooked up. You hear me all right? All right. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with you a little bit today. And there's no handouts, nice handouts in the folder for you, but some opportunity to take a few notes, perhaps. And talking about ethical concerns with death and dying, one of the first things that I'd like to say is just that the ethical concerns here are really largely theological concerns. And so when we're talking about ethical issues with death and dying, we're talking about theology. But we're also talking about pastoral care. And so I appreciate very much hearing what Dr. Cotrera had to say. And these issues came home to me when I was in seminary, and I served as a chaplain in a local hospital. And it was a large chaplain, large hospital. I wasn't a large chaplain, but it was a large hospital. And a large chaplain body. We had 9 of us serving under another 2 or 3 directors. And so I recall vividly the first, going through some orientation, having a sort of distribution of where we would serve in the hospital. And we made our top 3 choices, and then we went around and sort of drew lots and were able to pick as we went around the table. All of my top 3 choices were gone quite early, and so I was starting to think, now, where should I serve? And I had wanted to serve in the pediatric wing, which maybe now I'm glad that I didn't. I mean, that's certainly a very difficult area to serve in. But I saw as we were getting down to it, there were only a few more areas, and I was due to be second to last to pick. And so we came down to it, and the guy that was behind me was getting very nervous because the one place he did not want to serve, actually 2 places he did not want to serve, was in the emergency room and then in the intensive care unit. And so we got closer and closer, and finally, and there were actually a couple of extra units, and so some of us would serve more than one. So it comes down to it, and I don't know if this was a mistake or if I was sensing a movement of God just, you know, touching me, but I decided I would offer to serve in both of those places because there were going to be some extra places to go. So I volunteered at that point to serve in the emergency room and intensive care unit, and I don't know if I knew what I was doing at the time. But I think God did, and over the next few months, I was witness to and involved in more deaths than I could have imagined and that I had ever been close to before in my life. And so it brought home to me that what was at stake here was both theology and pastoral care. And I want to bring some of those issues to our attention today. I don't think I'll get through everything that that I might want to, but let me bring before you, first of all, some case studies, just to think. Now, one of the things that I'm quite certain of is that I'll raise more questions than I'll answer here. But it's important to raise certain questions so that we can start thinking about, you know, where do we go with this? But a lot of you would be familiar with the Terry Schiavo case in Florida, a woman who had a seizure in 1990 and suffered severe permanent brain damage, is dependent on a feeding tube to live. Her husband, Michael, is her guardian and wants the feeding tube removed, has argued that this is what Terry indicated verbally, though she didn't have anything in writing. And by the way, that does point to, as Dr. Couture mentioned, the significance of having some kind of advance directive to think about a living will or some of those issues. But her parents, on the other hand, want the tube to remain, and they argue that this is not what Terry would want. She would not want to die like this. There are some other disputed matters in this case, like whether she's actually in a persistent vegetative state or simply a prolonged coma. But it's created quite the stir, and any of you who have followed it have seen how it's played out in the Florida legislature. It's played out in the court. It may go to the Supreme Court. Right now, there's about a 30-day period where the Supreme Court may take it, and if they don't, then her feeding tube will likely be removed. How should we think through issues like this? Now, this one is particularly complicated for a number of reasons, but how should we think about it? Helga Wangley was a woman in Minnesota. In 1990, 86 years old, was admitted to the hospital with respiratory failure, was after many attempts, they could not wean her from the respirator, sent her to a special clinic, and they were not able to as either, and later suffered heart attack after an attempt to wean her, and also severe and irreversible brain damage. She was diagnosed as being in a persistent vegetative state, dependent upon heart and lung machine to stay alive. And so the doctors, after a certain amount of time, deemed that all treatment to try to save her or to try to have her be able to function again was futile because she was in a persistent vegetative state. The family did not challenge that diagnosis, but said that they wanted her to stay on life support and hope for a miracle. And in the end, it went to court, and the court in this case deemed that the husband was the only one who could make such a decision, and so she was allowed to stay alive. There were a lot of issues with this as well. Interestingly, by the time it went to the court, about $800,000 had been spent to keep her alive, and that actually never came up in the court case. It was never said this is an issue of financial resources, but no doubt this is always something of a concern. A couple of other cases. Infant Doe, this was a case in April of 1982, which made national headlines. A baby boy that was born with Down syndrome, and is. I think I left something out here, but anyway, esophageal atresia, which means that there was a problem with the esophagus and the baby could not swallow or take anything orally. In this case, the parents refuse to consent to surgery that would allow the doctors to remove the blockage so that the baby could take things orally, and the baby would then starve to death. Now, their primary care doctor agreed to this and said that the parent's decision was acceptable, but other doctors in the hospital and the hospital itself were not comfortable with this and ended up bringing it to court. The court, first a district court and then the Indiana Supreme Court, ruled in the parents' favor, said that the hospital and the doctors could not override the parents' decision in this case, and the baby died of starvation April 15th, just 6 days later. The thing about this case is that if the infant had not had Down syndrome, there was no question that the parents would have approved of the surgery. And so ultimately, this baby was starved to death because it had Down syndrome. And so it's come up a lot in ethical discussions of infanticide, that if infanticide is in fact practiced in some sense in cases in the United States. Another case, conjoined twins named Jody and Mary. And they were born in the year 2000 in a Mediterranean island, brought to the United Kingdom so that they could get the best care possible. And it was determined that both could not live. They shared vital organs, and that both could not live. If they did surgery, then they could save one, but the other would die in the surgery or as a result of the surgery. If they did not do surgery, then they would both die, most likely within about 3 months. Now, this is the weighty decision then that was placed upon the parents. And the parents said, we simply cannot go through with this surgery because it would be killing one of our children. The doctor said, if you don't go through with it, both of your children are going to die. We have an opportunity to save one of them. And ended up going to court. In this case, the court overruled the parents' wishes and said that they must go through with the surgery. Now, this was a very, very sort of perplexing case, and the way that many in Britain responded to this was not what you might expect. But one of the things that we saw out of that was pro-life organizations in Britain who stood out to say, this is horrible, this is awful, that the court would effectively give a death sentence to one of these children. I'm not so sure that they were right in making that kind of a judgment. In this case, I think that the difficulty is overruling a parent's decision in such a complex case. But it's not quite to say that there's lacking here sanctity of human life. Now, one or two others. Those would be things that typically you will not face. And I hope that you will not have to face such things. But occasionally you may find yourself in a situation of pastoral care where a very difficult decision like that is before you. Other times, it'll be a more common type of case, a case of Tricia, somebody that I know who has been diagnosed on three separate occasions with cancer and most recently treated for 6 months aggressively with chemotherapy. She is a very strong woman but has been racked with cancer and more so with the chemo. The chemo has really made her bedridden, and after 6 months of treatment went back in and it was discovered that the cancer had spread into her rib cage and so forth. And now the doctors are saying, we don't know that we can do anything that will be effective in treating this. We can try chemotherapy again, but we've tried that, and we don't know that it's going to be effective. And Tricia at this point has said, I don't want to go through any more of that. What do you do in a situation like that? Is this sort of suicidal of her? Do you say, well, you must do all that you can, anything that you might try? Now, she doesn't wish to die. In fact, she's looking for alternatives and things like that. But this is the kind of situation that I'm confident that many of you will face at some point. Another one, case of Alden, an older man who is had Parkinson's disease, and it's well advanced. He has a great deal of difficulty swallowing now, and so is unable to get enough nutrition orally to keep him alive. And so he is being partially tube-fed to just give him enough calories. He's unable to walk, sometimes unable to sit up, sometimes unable to keep his eyes open, and his situation is declining. He's 72 years old. And what do you do in a situation like this? Now, he was diagnosed with pneumonia, and the hospice care responsible for him said that we should not give anything for this. We don't want to give any medication except perhaps some comfort medication if he needs that. Do we agree with that? You know, antibiotics to treat pneumonia for a person in this condition. What should we do? Those are some of the difficulties. I want to give you some resources because we won't be able to resolve a lot of these things in the time that we have, but I do want to point you in some helpful directions. The Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity is a great resource, and you see the website there. This is operating out of Trinity International University in Deerfield, Illinois, and one of our former faculty members, Ben Mitchell, is very much involved there. They've got some very good things. John Kilner is another one who's been very helpful, who's there. Also, the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, you see their site there. That's cmdahome.org, if you can't read it very well. Another very helpful site. Will give you some resources there and discussion and things like this. They even have some PowerPoint things that you can download and you could use in church in some presentations and so forth. There are some parts of the site that you have to be a member to get into, but you can get a lot without membership. And then Larson and Amundsen, it's a very helpful theological reflection, particularly looking at the early church and attitudes towards death. It's called A Different Death. And one other resource that I'll put up there right now is John Wyatt, Matters of Life and Death. John Wyatt is a pediatrician from England and serves in the London area, and also a very able theologian, has worked for a number of years with John Stott. And this book is the result of a lot of that and some helpful reflection on important issues. I won't stop and talk about all of these things just to raise some of the ethical issues that are at play when we talk about death and dying, patient autonomy, compassion. What is compassion when it comes to death and dying? Many who would argue for killing in some sense, hastening death, euthanasia, argue from the motive of compassion for that person who's dying. What is true Christian compassion when it comes to these issues? The right to die and the right to life both play into this case because, as you see in the one case, Terry Schiavo, it's in part a right to life case that her family is arguing for. In other cases, there's a right to die that is raised there. What about medical treatment and futility? When a hospital or doctors judge that all treatment at this point is futile, how do we rule? In the case of Helga Wangley, they ruled this very thing. And yet courts overruled the doctor's judgment and said the parents had to make, or the husband had to make a decision in that case. Generally speaking, hospitals do not need to, hospitals don't have to answer to patients in terms of doing anything that the patient might demand, where futile treatment, where they deem the treatment to be futile. But there are some very difficult cases, some gray areas. By the way, the Supreme Court ruled some time back that medically assisted nutrition and hydration, that is, food and water through tube feeding and so forth, is deemed to be medical treatment. which has far-reaching ethical implications because, of course, all of us depend upon food and water to live. So if you have somebody who requires tube feeding and hydration in order to live, but doctors can say this will not heal them, this will not save them, then it's deemed futile medical treatment and it may be removed. This is one of the issues that comes into the Terry Schiavo case. There are others who I think rightly argue that this shouldn't be deemed medical treatment. If it was, it's rather futile in all of our cases for healing diseases and things like that. It's simply necessary for life. The issue of killing versus letting die, we may raise in just a moment. Or the issue of playing God. This is interesting because as I've talked to students, this comes up in different ways. What is it to play God when it comes to the end of life? Is it that we are hastening death and we ought not to do that? Or in some cases, is it that we are simply postponing the dying process or prolonging the dying process? Is that playing God? And I've had students who will argue that we ought to do all that we possibly can to keep someone alive. But there are others who will say, no. No, there's a point at which we need to recognize that this person is dying and let them die and help them grieve through that process. Do we always need to keep alive? Issues of active versus passive euthanasia. And a number of other things I'll put up here just very quickly. DNR orders. This is something that I'm quite confident that many of you will have to deal with in terms of counseling people who are your responsibility in ministry. Pastor, should we write a DNR order? Which means that we will not resuscitate if this person has heart failure and that sort of thing, or do not intubate. What should we do, Pastor? Is this right, biblically speaking, and that sort of thing? I think it is important, in fact, that we talk with people through these things so that their wishes would be known, which raises the question of advanced directives and the living will. So that some of you, if you've had a hospital admission in recent years, sometimes for even a minor thing, although most hospital admissions we don't consider minor when it's us being admitted, but if you've had this, they'll often ask you, do you have a living will, and would you like to fill one out? I went in for knee surgery, and I was asked this, and I wondered, what were you expecting out of this knee surgery? But this is for any case, so that you will have something on record. Now, the difficulty with a living will is that it's nearly impossible to predict all the possible scenarios surrounding sickness and death and so forth. So you can't necessarily say something that will tell the doctors what to do in every situation that you face. And so some have turned to something of a combination, having a living will that you've expressed yourself on certain issues, but then also turning to somebody with a durable power of attorney for healthcare. So that, for instance, in my situation where I might express clearly and on paper certain things like in the event of a cardiac arrest, I don't want to be resuscitated, and it may depend on certain other situations and so forth. But since I can't exhaust all the possibilities, then I turn to my wife, who can become durable power of attorney for making such decisions. Knowing my wishes, knowing just what I would want to have done in certain cases, and having talked to her about my understanding of life and death and things like that, where she is given the authority to make such decisions. This is sometimes difficult still, because in a situation like Michael Schiavo and Terry Schiavo, a spouse that has authority to make such decisions, where their spouse's wishes were not known, may not be acting in their spouse's best interest. And that's what then the medical staff and sometimes, sadly, the court needs to decide. By the way, in their case, Michael Schiavo was awarded, well, Michael and Terry Schiavo were awarded $2 million in a malpractice suit. And in that case, Michael Schiavo argued that he is married to her, for better or for worse, till death do they part, and that he would care for her until the end of her life. And so he was awarded, or they were awarded, $2 million. About 4 months later, at least as some read the events, he started working towards her death by first issuing a do not resuscitate order and other things. Now, I don't think that necessarily was the tip-off, but it has been a serious case of neglect, I think, because he hasn't spent a great deal of that $2 million on her care. Some of it has gone, certainly, but a lot of it hasn't. And he has since fathered two children and has been living with a woman. And how the court can still say he is the guardian of this woman is beyond me, especially when he will get a large sum of money that goes to him then if she dies. But anyway, assuming that we can trust our spouse and put our care in their hands, which we ought to all be able to do, then we want to talk about a living will and a durable power of attorney for health care. Now, just to raise some of the key issues and things that are important for thinking through these issues, I would put it into a couple of categories. One is foundational moral truths and related to death and dying, and then some moral principles related to death and dying. And among the moral truths, we could spell out more than I will here, but is to affirm that human beings are created in the image of God, and that we are to care for one another and love one another as fellow creatures created in God's image. Also, we can affirm that life is good. Life is a good, but it is not an ultimate good. And there is sometimes in especially acute situations with families that life can become something of an idol that we will not let go. Now, a lot goes into that, including the grieving and shock and a lot of the things that Dr. Cotrer had talked about. It's not an easy time to make decisions, but sometimes we want to cling and grasp and hope beyond hope. And there's a time for letting go and just... Some would argue, in the case of Helga Wangley, the family recognized her situation, but they were hoping and praying for a miracle, that God can do anything. Well, in fact, it is true that God can do anything. And in fact, we could remove somebody from life support and hope that God might do something then. But there's a time when we need to let go. We need to recognize also that life is a gift. We are not our own, which is one of the reasons that issues of autonomy, at least as we're thinking as Christians, it may be a more difficult case to make in the public square, but as we think as Christians, the issue of autonomy or something like the right to death is cast very differently because we are not our own. And so we have to think through the more theological issue of what is God's will here, not necessarily and primarily what is my right here. And by the way, it's interesting that some have argued that you cannot find the right to die in the Constitution because the Constitution presumes that you are alive and fighting for positive rights for the one who is alive. So thinking of the right to die is a different matter altogether there. But another one, that suffering may be redemptive. Now, in terms of pastoral care matters, appreciate what Dr. Cotrer has shared with us, and thinking and understanding and affirming that suffering may be redemptive is different from saying that, hey, your suffering is for your good. And trying to break in there and say, you know, this is something that you ought to rejoice in. You have to allow people to grieve in their own suffering as well and pray with them and stay with them and pray that they will find God's will, God's plan for them, even through the suffering. Then some moral principles. The sanctity of human life versus the quality of life. One thing that we've seen in And some of the medical statements, moving from something like the Hippocratic Oath, which reflects a little more closely the Judeo-Christian affirmation of the sanctity of life, what we've seen in the last 50, 60 years or so from the Nuremberg Code forward is more of a shift to a respect for life, which has weakened this very much to the point where if you have respect for life, you can always find a way to say, well, we respect this person, but we're going to allow them to die, or in some cases, we're going to assist in their death. The sanctity of human life versus a respect for life or the quality of life. Out of the sanctity of human life and quality and high regard for life comes a first medical principle, do no harm. One of the things that's critical as we think about the issue of euthanasia is whether or not it's ever the truly compassionate thing to do, to kill. And something like a firm rule that we do no harm, we do not actually intend killing, is critical for acting rightly. And so here it spells out in the assertion that we are always to care and never to kill. Our intention matters very much. Now, and one other thing, put in the cast in autonomy and community. Autonomy is an important thing, but it needs to be held in relation to both community and to the idea that we belong to God and we are not our own. And now, out of all of these things, I would suggest at least a general principle that we need not seek to avoid death at all costs. We need not to cling to life and seek to prolong the dying process, but we must never aim at death. Dr. Kutera hinted at something of pain medication, for instance. You know, what do we do when somebody is suffering greatly? Can we give them greater pain medication, even to the point where it may put their life at risk? In the use of morphine, for instance, it may suppress respiration, and the person could die given a certain amount of morphine. It seems to me in cases like that a lot can be done to control the pain. And by the way, doctors and ethicists think about pain in all of its aspects, not just physical pain, but emotional pain and things like that. And there's a concept called total pain that relates to that. And the physical pain is greatly aggravated by emotional pain and things like that. And a lot of times, that is the result of feeling isolated, feeling all alone, and things like that. And so the community that comes around somebody who is suffering can help to alleviate a great deal of the emotional pain, which in the end helps to alleviate a great deal of the physical pain, because these things, or the total pain, because these things are related. Now, in a case where we might need to increase the pain medication, even where there's risk of suppressed breathing, it seems to me we can justify doing that if that's not our intention to end death, but we're simply trying to control the pain. And we need to think about those matters of intention and so forth. I want to last share with you some scripture that I think are important for reflection. And there's much more that we could do and say about the issue of euthanasia, for instance, and what sort of cases you might face are cases of euthanasia and what are not. But we'll have to leave that for another time. I want to share with you a few texts, and you might at least jot down these references. Thinking about how our bodies are not our own, think about, first of all, the creation, that in fact God has created us. And that suggests this in the first place. But also Paul's reflection, 1 Corinthians 6:19. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. Now, as you know, in the context, Paul is relating this to sexual morality and so forth. But it clearly also illustrates the principle that, we are not our own. And our decisions need to be prayerful decisions made with the realization that our bodies, our very bodies, are from God and for God. Redemptive suffering and trusting God. Think about 2 Corinthians 1, 8 and 9. Paul reflecting on the sufferings that he had endured, both physical, emotional, spiritual, and so forth. We were under great pressure, he says, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, in our hearts we felt the sentence of death. But this happened that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. And then also in Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 12, 9, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Now, let me say, stop. I've got a couple more texts that I want to share. But I want to stop here and say that you have to be very careful not to use these texts. And as Dr. Contreras said, so often what you need to do is simply be present and to be with the person who is suffering, not to go in there and say, let me open the Word of God to you and tell you why your suffering is from God and why it's a good thing and why God can help you through this. There'll be a time to talk about those things, but it's not, you have to read clearly where a person is at, what they are looking for. And a lot of times they're not looking for that yet. They're just looking for you to be right near them. Many years ago, one of my best friends and cousin and his wife were in a car accident, and my cousin and his wife were thrown out of the car. She was paralyzed and lost all feeling in her legs and has been paralyzed since. It's been close to 20 years now. Within about 6 months, so many people had given her books, articles, verses that were meant as encouragements, but to sort of try to explain to her why this had happened, why God had allowed this, and why it could be for good. And you know, the case of Johnny Erickson was you know, one that was constantly told her. Well, there was a time when that became very helpful to her, but it was not in the first 6 months after her accident. At that time, she was going through processes of grieving, of just real pain in terms of what had happened and how this had changed her life and all of these things. And so we got to be careful in how we seek to minister to somebody who is suffering. But these are important texts nonetheless for our own reflection to understand how do we think through these issues. And I've just got one or two more and I'll stop. Romans 8:38, for I am convinced that neither life nor death, nor angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus. And one last text on comfort for and from the afflicted. Coming from 2 Corinthians 1. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we will be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. When we have received some kind of affliction, it helps us to relate to and comfort others who are in affliction. And that is one of the reasons, as believers, when we are afflicted, we can take comfort in how God might use that to help us comfort others. But at the same time, God will use some others who have been afflicted to help comfort us through that time. And the end of that text, for just as the sufferings of Christ are ours in abundance, so also our comfort, misspelling there, is abundant through Christ. I'll leave it here. I know our time is gone. We're over in many ways. I will not be able to be at the panel discussion later, and so I would very much welcome any discussions you want on a one-to-one basis another time. But I appreciate your attention and time here today, and for Dr. Ewart and Dr. Drake, who I understand has left us, for their organizing this. What a great event today. So thank you for your time.